Welcome to this audio podcast of Hamburg Open Online University at the Hochschule für Musik und Theater Hamburg. My name is Vincent Dombrowski, and I want to welcome you to this podcast about microtonality on the saxophone, especially in jazz and improvised music. I'm glad to be joined by extraordinary saxophone players from different musical backgrounds that will share their different perspectives on this matter with us. Maybe you could just introduce yourselves, starting with you, Hayden.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Vincent, for the great introduction. My name's Hayden, and I'm a saxophone player from New Zealand. I moved to Europe when I was 17, and I've predominantly played jazz most of my life, and I still do. But very early on, I got hooked on this bug and was really interested in the subject we're going to talk about today, which is like going inside the tones, like the smaller tones. And it's something that's like carried me through my life. And yeah, that's about it.
So, Philip?
So, yeah, my name is Philip Gerschlauer. I'm a saxophone player living in Berlin right now. And doing microtonal music for over 10 years right now. And for me, it's also a way that language, jazz language, melody and harmonies can be expanded and go in completely new directions where you wouldn't think that it's possible, to play it, but the ear buys it because the tones and the relation of tones is accessible to the ear.
My name is Vlatko Kučan. I'm a saxophone player and clarinetist living in Hamburg, originally born in Sarajevo, Bosnia, but living for the most part of my life in Germany. And I have a background. I started out listening and playing jazz, but very soon in my early 20s, I got connected to what was called improvised music, or still called European improvised music. So these are the two backgrounds that I keep maintaining, developing, and integrating, which is another interesting story, but not the topic of today. And I've been for the past 5 years teaching improvisation at the Hochschule für Musik in Hamburg, and I'm the head of the newly founded Studio für Polystylistic Improvisation and Interdisciplinary Crossover, which we prefer to call SPEAK. And it's great to be here with you guys.
Hello, I'm Asia Fateva. I'm from Crimea originally, but I live half of my life in Germany already, so I feel really at home here. My background is very classical, I must say. I started with piano, classical music, when I was 6. And then with 10, saxophone, and then I was studying in Moscow, in Köln, and then Paris, Lyon, and Montpellier, so very French also inspired, until, let's say, 1 or 2 years before it was really only classical. Classical, of course, when I say classical, it means new music a lot. It means all the modern composers. It means collaboration with composers. So that's why microtonals a lot. And since 1 or 2 years, I'm really curious about improvisation. So also this aspect is in my life now.
So today we will be talking about microtones, as you have already heard in the introduction and also in the statements of my guests. So we will talk about all the tones that are smaller than a semitone. So there are many different ways of splitting the octave, and we will talk about different concepts of doing that and different ways of doing that. And I will just ask a couple of questions, but from that point we can start on just discussing. So if you feel free to open up the questions and start discussing with each other and not wait for my questions. So I have lots of questions prepared, but we will just see what happens. So I would like to start with asking how you got involved with microtonality.
So I can start. I mean, first encounter I had was, I think it must have been in 2003 or 2004, you know, these features that you see on the radio on HR2, like in the middle of the night, and there was a feature of Ernst Albrecht Stiebler, who talked about the relation of the infinite steps by Escher and its musical equivalent. So he was talking about Tenny and about music that was based on overtones. And I recall that I was struck I was insane moment when I listened to this feature. I called them later, wanted to get the music, but they couldn't give me the music because it was they didn't have the rights to give it away. But that was just the first encounter when I realized, wow, there is more than just like 12 notes in music, and this can create an amazing and beautiful sound. But I didn't have the tools, I was too young, but it was just like one little seed that was there from this moment. And I think in a way it was waiting to come out. Then I went to study classical saxophone as a youth student, and had some encounters with microtonality there, but it was not too precise, defined language on microtonality. It was quarter tones, but it didn't matter if they are right in the center of two half notes. But yeah, I learned some fingerings back then. It was a cool way to play and a new experience. And then when I started jazz, it was actually through Hayden's work with Route 70, the Fahrvergnügen. When I listened to the, I don't know which song it was, but the erste Nummer of the Fahrvergnügen. It was just like, wow, I also want to do stuff like that, you know? So I went home and tried to find quarter tone fingerings and just tried to compose and to play it without any goal, but just learning by doing. And that's been the start. Yeah, I'm done.
Hayden, maybe you could just...
I remember quite clearly when I was about 18 and 19, studying in Cologne. My teacher back then, Frank Radkowski, he told me one day at lessons, you know, there's one tone between like D-flat and B. And I said, what do you mean a tone? Like, and he showed me this one little, this finger on the side, and it like all that really set something on fire. Like, I thought, oh man, I just wanted to know, like, what else is there? That was kind of my first maybe one-to-one experience with, you know, a way to understand these tones between the tones. Now when I look back at my life, I remember listening to quite a lot of blues music when I was young. And of course, as we might come to later, there are so many other kinds of music around that use, you know, these smaller tones in different ways. Maybe Vlatko from his youth, like down here in the Balkans, but you know, not really consciously knowing how to go into it. And so this like one moment in my studies in Cologne really set something off. And then I was, you know, really interested to discover what else is out there, you know, between the tones.
Yeah. Well, I totally agree. In my case, I would say I didn't really realize that I was into microtonal music since this name appeared, and I got the information and got I started working with one with some people and had to play a composition which was written and with microtonal pitches. But in my opinion, every music is microtonal. There's no such thing as music that is not microtonal, because our instruments, our traditional instruments, produce different pitches, and even if you try to tune them perfectly, they are never perfectly in tune. And we as humans, we produce various pitches all the time, so we don't produce sine waves with a fixed frequency. And so to me it seems that we are, when we're talking about microtonality, and that's my perspective, is that we are, I try to think of it as different frameworks of organization of pitches. And so we have the traditional, the atonic or chromatic framework, and we have the many other frameworks, and which are narrower, finer frameworks. But there's a philosophical question, maybe we can come to this later, what that actually means. So we have, with more pitches that we agree on, we have more possibilities, we have more combinations, but we are also have the risk or the danger of losing what is in German so perfectly called the Spielraum, the space where we can create, where expression happens. So if you're narrowing that down, so we lose something, we win something. So I found this to be a very, very interesting, for my work, very interesting topic. Basically, what are pitches? And also we know that people, everyone hears differently. You know, even if you try to play in a traditional way, Western way, in tune, some people like to hear things flat or a little bit sharp, or certain intervals are different. And I think that's something, sort of human factor. To put it simply, it's something that is of very interesting for me, theoretically and practically.
So it's about emotion, right?
Absolutely.
I think in Wien classic sometimes it was used the quarter tones, the semitones, but I mean, to improve the intonation basically, because usually when we start with saxophone it's pretty out of tune and some notes are usually always too high and so on. So to get this feeling, what is right, actually we divide the intervals even smaller, smaller, smaller. So really we start with pretty young students and pupils to play all these quarter tones to really be able to hear. So as you mentioned, it's important to educate your ears. And if you with this educate your ears, and if you can really try to hear it, and with saxophone it's easy because you can play everything with fingers. So to combine these both, it actually improves your also playing a lot. And then of course we in touch with so many composers who are using this, and to destroy the space and to destroy this feeling of safety, I think it's really the best way to use it, because that there are some pieces that you for minutes you're listening and you know where are you. You're even traveling so much with all this destruction of very, very small intervals, and it's amazing. And then when you hear the perfect fourth or fifth, then it's like, wow.
Is this a tradition that is also being used for other instruments, like violins, using quarter tones to improve
it's
intonation?
It's different because they have to do it it's very flexible. They don't have the key, so it's very, have really to know position. I think there with strings, I cannot talk for strings, but I suppose that there you have to educate your ear even better, because you don't have the position for your fingers like this, precise.
Because I know there are schools for violins as early as the 19th century that first introduced quarter tones in a way for playing to improve.
Oh, it was early, because for saxophone it came
intonation is the earliest school and book I know where quarter tones appear to teach music. So this is a Russian.
Oh, okay, because
tradition.
In saxophone it came much later for sure, in 20th century.
Makes sense, yeah.
So we were already talking about a little bit about teaching and also maybe practicing. Could you tell me how you would start practicing or your hearing and also technique for, like, there are lots of fingerings, but especially to really get the pitch and to know what you're doing, how would you attack that?
You're looking at me, so
I don't know. Maybe whoever feels obligated to answer.
I mean, I can start. So one way. So first of all, I mean, I'm not super nerdy and crazy about whether it's the right pitch, because as I said earlier in the video shoot, when I'm on stage, it's about feeling, and it's not about being right or wrong. It's more about that microtones transport an emotion, and I want to hit a certain emotion. And I tune with my heart like a blues player, and I'm not interested in whether this is a certain ratio that I approached or not. But what I do use is trying to match the microtonal keyboard. I'm using a microtonal keyboard, so just trying to blend in the sound that's already in the room, and which is also a nice way to communicate, because you're not saying you're too sharp or too flat. And expanding language, for me, the best way was just is composing. Just composing songs, because when you compose songs with quarter tones or I don't know any tone system, then you have an emotional connection to it. And I like this idea that lots of things I play based on a composition, because then I'm emotionally attached and they appear in different contexts. Like, it's almost when you listen to Ornette Coleman, like everything he plays is like a song, or could be a child song, or could be a quote from there, could be a quote from that, but it was all a melody once. That's where it came from. So
Philip, if I could just butt in there and just add, I mean, it's the very fact that we have this podcast, I mean, means there's probably a lot of, you know, young players, younger musicians out there that do have an interest in this, these like tone worlds.
Yeah.
And all of us would agree, like, we're all coming from different directions. But it's a tool, obviously, you know, it's a way to maybe, you know, increase our expression, to to get closer to what we really want, the story we want to tell, you know. So we can talk about, of course, the technical sides of it and how they can get into that. I think young players will sometimes hear something, it touches them, something special, they want to learn it, they do. You know, it could be any kind of direction, you know, but it's, I think, really important to stress. We have this instrument that can do almost anything, and we're using these kind of tools to just broaden how, you know, what we want to do. You know, I think we'll always come back to that, rather than, you know, we can always get tied up in the whole technicalities, but at the end of the day, it's just another beautiful tool we have, you know, to go into the tones.
It's also just one side of the coin, right? It's also only pitch and sound, but didn't talk about time and groove.
And the timbre and the interrelation between pitch and timbre, which is quite interesting, how those two relate. So to answer your question from my side, so and pick up on what I've said before, so for me the learning process was really, I think for most people is, you listen to music and you find things that touch you, that you think is great. You're trying to imitate, like we're learning a language, the old traditional way, trying to imitate. And by that we find out to, we learn the pitches. And as Ornette is a great example, you know, or you can listen to Ben Webster or Evan Parker. So there, you know, it's microtonal music.
It's super microtonal.
All the time. So in order to be able to reproduce these things, we have to learn different things. We have to first be able to hear them, then we have to be able to reproduce them, to find the ways technically, and also on along the way, learn to avoid mistakes, and also that we don't play sharp because we have not figured out our embouchure or setup or whatever, so that we can find the tones that we are looking for. And I always try to think as playing the saxophone, and I'm sure it's true for most instruments, if not for all, it's really to get into a singing, to be a singer, and to try to sing the pitches. And a singer cannot hold to anything. You have to, you have to hear the pitch, you have to feel it, and then you can produce it. And I think it's pretty same with our instruments. And everything else is just something that needs to get out of the way.
And just to add that I'm very agree that it's can be connected and should be maybe connected to emotions, the quarter tones, because how to explain how to feel it, of course, as you're really very right, it's one thing, but if you really feel it and if you use it to increase the feeling or increase this something, this tension, or maybe not, this is really the best way to integrate it, and that's really would be my advice.
Yeah, and I agree to what you have said, Hayden, it's like another set of tools, another palette of colors, if you will, you know. And it can be compared if you're in traditional jazz and you start learning and you're learning your scales and you are in major scale harmony, and in the diatonic world, and then you discover the chromatic world, and suddenly you have like the pastel colors, and it completely changes. And the microtonality is another completely other set of colors,
the digital world
that are available for us. And
yeah, you mentioned the this incredible connection between the intonation and the tone color, the timbre, which is something that continues to fascinate and amaze me. And you know, the feeling that, you know, players have when it really locks in, when a certain thing really connects with the intonation, just how the tone itself is somehow transformed. And that's something that can be of, you know, incredible value, this kind of work. I think no matter what kind of music you end up playing, it's something that's very hard to put into words, but we all know the feeling, you know, when it's really in that perfect relationship, you know, whatever that is for the individual person. But yeah.
Were there some teachers or other artists you listened to who inspired you to work on microtonality, or was it just like an inner urge?
I'm pretty sure all of us would have encountered people that, you know, inspire you with some special urge or something. But at the end of the day, I think it sets something alight inside you, and then you follow it through. You know, it could be anything. I think it's why it's so important that young children have like somehow sound experiences, like really just beyond music, like something that really, you know, gets them heading towards music in a good way. And so I imagine for all of us, we've had, you know, teachers along the way, but I guess it's mainly been something inside ourselves that's, you know, driven us to go a bit further into this, into the sound. And I also have to say, it's what I also mentioned, something very beautiful that goes throughout life. I find these experiences even deeper now in the middle of my life, and which is a great thing about the saxophone and what we do. It can just keep on, you know, I have the feeling, and it sounds a bit funny, that you can keep on going deeper inside the tones themselves, you know, discovering all kinds of new things within them, you know. And that might sound a bit stupid to someone from the outside, but it's a great thing that accompanies us in our lives as saxophonists.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said teachers, because I found the most revealing and thing for me that there was no teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever saxophone, when I started studying jazz saxophone, these microtones and the things I could do, they were my private thing, the field I could work on, where there were new things to discover and to explore, where nobody would tell me, hey, let's use quarter tones because then you have more melodies. I don't think I would have become what I do right now if this would have been inside a school system. Because everything you find out for yourself has this kind of magic that we all know, you know what I'm talking about. And this gets lost if you read a book or if someone teaches you that. And it was just amazing because I could go any direction after my after my regular studies. And
as a classical saxophone, you cannot do this experience, I guess, because...
Why not?
Because you have teachers who will tell you, usually, because the teachers use it really. You have very early the music where it's written. You have very early teachers who is doing with you. I do with my students scales in quarter tones. So it's really from the beginning we do all these notes, so you don't have to invent the bicycle, let's say. It's there. So all the fingering, all the things are there. And so I think you will not have time or possibility to discover it for yourself because it's kind of really very early part of the education, let's say, became for the other pieces also the fundament.
I think I totally agree. It's a process of learning, of developing the ears, of maturing as a musician, as a human being, and developing a relationship. I call this tonal pitch organization like a framework, right? Mm-hmm. And a framework is not oppressive by itself. It's just the interpretation of the framework which can become oppressive. So if you are told you have to play exactly in tune and you're supposed to play like that and you're supposed to play with that timbre, then the system gets oppressive. And I think at some point, everyone who has had a Western education at some point has run into this kind of experience of the oppressive system, and which is, to say, to use a philosophical metaphor, a representation of power and hierarchy, right? So in a classical orchestra, Western classical orchestra, the orchestra musicians have to obey the rules very strictly, whereas the soloist has a certain freedom of expression. These are the rules. So, and if you are involved in jazz or improvisation, where your own expression, whatever that might be, that's another intriguing topic. But whatever we do when we play, becomes personal, but not in a vacuum. We don't perform in a vacuum. We perform in a cultural context, in a social context, and we deal with different relations of power and hierarchies, and exploring and finding the courage to explore the intermediate space, which at times you get into uncertain, into no man's land or no woman's land, where where, you know, you're prone to make mistakes, you're prone to play wrong, not quote wrong notes, notes that don't sound right, but somehow I think you are driven by your instinct, and you have to and you think, well, there's something I can make this sound, I can make this timbre, I can make this line into a melody that sounds right. And I find this an ongoing process, and very, very much, although I wouldn't call myself an expert on microtonality in a way that I say, well, that's what I do. It's, as I said, a part of my repertoire, but a very, it's become more and more important to try to find solutions, ways to incorporate this world into my language.
Mm. I agree. I would also add on to that that there's an enormous feeling of liberation or freedom that comes along understanding that there is no rigid structure or framework within the octave. You know, you can do
exactly
whatever you want to. And all of us, to a certain extent, do grow up as musicians thinking music should be maybe like this or this or this as young people. And so once young people or we, you know, get into the world of microtonality, whatever you want to call it, opening up the octave or the space between the tones, there's a great feeling which also I think ties a lot to life and what you really need now of understanding what that really means to be free in that, of course, with responsibilities and whatnot. But it's a huge sense of liberation, I find, for young players to discover, to go into this world.
But do you think universities are fast enough to keep up with this development?
I mean, that's probably that's a whole other topic for another podcast.
I would say it's never the institutions; it's the people who make the institutions. So,
it's the people who pay the people.
No. I have maybe one question too. Can I also ask questions?
Mm.
If you write music with microtonality, you use a notation, exact notation, or you don't write it, or what do you?
So I mean, there's you have to find a way how to communicate what you want to say to mm-hmm. someone who doesn't know it best. And the way to get there, you can freely choose your options. There's dozens of ways how to write microtonal and how to notate microtonal music. You have accidentals. What I do, I'm not using quarter tones or eighths of tones. I'm using all kinds of different pitches. So I write half tones plus 50 cents or mm-hmm. minus 50 cents maximum. So I wouldn't write A plus 61 cents, just so I would write B flat minus 39.
And you don't use a quarter?
No, the quarter mm-hmm. tones accidentals. But that's just a thing that I don't like to read more than plus 50 cents, because then it's... But also depends on the fingerings, on the saxophone, because some fingerings are clearly more A than B flat.
Okay.
And so I think it's a... but yeah.
What do we...
I've never written anything.
Okay.
in microtonal, not anything, but I'm trying to avoid that. I don't write that much in general, being an improviser. It's not that I don't believe in composition, quite the opposite, but it's not something that I spend most of my time with. I like to organize music, but it's not necessarily in a written. Mm-hmm. With written scores, let me put it that way. And it was one frustrating experience for me some years ago when I actually, someone came for a recording session with a composition, and I had it just a few days before, and I had to reorganize the fingerings that I've been using like for a long time, but I've never systematically organized them. And it was very hard work to reproduce the score, and because of lack of experience in that case, and it was quite the opposite than a liberating experience. But that's another subject. Now that's kind of the reproduction and the difficulties and involved with notation. And we know that mm-hmm. classical notation is very limited, and we are
for sure.
making it more complex, or the task even more complex. With but I would another thought that just is crossing my mind regarding teachers and how to learn it. I think it's very valuable experience, and anyone listening who wants to get into microtonality, find someone who has some experience with it. You know, because what we do as musicians, at the end of the day, we are tuning in. We are tuning to each other. We are trying to find a resonance in our sounds, and if you have a chance to play with someone whose language is microtonal, then you have to deal with it, and you have to find a way to blend and to resonate, and that's the best way to learn it. In my case, I was very fortunate to have met Bar Phillips as one example. I've been working with Bar for the past 15 years on different occasions, and I remember the very first session we were doing some project with film music, and the pitches he was playing on the bass were a challenge for me. I had to really to learn how to relate to it, but it was an ear-opening experience. So I think that's a very good way.
Yeah, another. I'm sure, like for a lot of us, if we're going back to young players, it was really hard for me to play the piano when I was younger, because I never really understood the tuning of the piano deeply, why it was like that, and with just even simple things like major chords. And I often tell young players, no matter what you do with this stuff, whether you use it or not, you know, it certainly helps all kinds of situations like that. When you go back to play with the piano, no piano player can tell you, oh, you're out of tune. Of course, you're like, what do you mean I'm out of tune? You know, and just it helps you to understand those relationships. And now it's much, much easier for me to do something like that, to play with the piano, to shift and slide, to play with different situations in lower tunings, higher tunings, with all kinds of, you know, people. I believe anyway that the saxophone is the instrument par excellence that can do anything, that can play with anyone, you know, from a whisper to a roar, any continent with anything. And adding, I think, the tuning to that just has been something that's been very important for me over the years.
Yeah. Well, as an aside, since you mentioned the piano, we all know the experience improvising with a piano player, and if the piano player is not experienced and flexible, the instrument has an enormous power tonally, and if it's been used in a traditional way, it's always the saxophonist in our case who sounds wrong, right? Because that's the way how we're trained to relate. So we relate the melody to the harmony, and so this is. It takes tuning in from both sides, and it's another challenge, completely different challenge for piano players, for example, to live in a environment, microtonal environment.
Yeah, I think in the past 10 years, so much new software came out that it's much easier to program a microtonal keyboard or to have different microtonal devices than it was like 10 or 15 years ago. Mm. So I think we are really on a change of times in a way that we are not bound to a physical instrument anymore. We can retune. We are not limited to 12 keys per octave, where we need to decide how to tune a piano or how to tune our instruments. But we can change and switch that with softwares, with foot pedals.
Yeah, I agree. And Philip, I'm not sure. I think we all teach here in this. In this podcast in different formats, and it's a funny thing I've noticed that there's so many, you know, incredible young players I'm encountering going deeply into these kind of worlds and stuff, which is a nice kind of a contrast to the rest of the world, the state of the world at the moment, like a lot of very difficult things going on.
Right.
But in music, I'm constantly surprised and really encouraged by the young people coming through with a deep, deep interest in expanding, you know, our particular instruments, vocabulary, but also really going deeper into the music with this kind of work, which is great in many different ways and different styles of music.
Yeah, I mean, I also would not consider myself to be particularly old, but I remember when I started playing saxophone, it could be quite a task to get one or the other recording, to get to listen to it, what you could have on YouTube right now.
Absolutely.
So
it's sometimes also overwhelming as a young player, but it's still, as both of you said, for me, one of the reasons to do this podcast is to find a way and to talk to people who I admire in a way as players and also as musicians, and to get to know. Yeah, what I found very interesting about the last 2 days already was that all people kind of tune in the same thing, saying that microtones aren't a way of, that they are only a tool and not a way of like a genre like micro jazz or like a certain thing you have to do, like a technique or something, but it's more like a tool you can use to develop emotional music. So that was very heartwarming for me as a researcher, because the first thing when I started researching, it was like a closed book, it was just an interest. So
you know, I think Helene Fischer and Bach, Yeah, no. Helene Fischer and Bach, they use the same tone system, and you would never consider them to say they are similar musicians, right? But just because we are dealing with way more possibilities, it's like, oh, you're doing also microtonal music. It's just bizarre.
But before Bach, it was not such. He was the one who was actually inventing the system of temperate.
I don't want to get into that.
So maybe before we were listening.
I think we've all come through probably in some form various dogmatic, let's say, systems and sense of like music should be like this or this. And this world is completely open. So it's it opens something beyond, you know, what music should or, you know, could be. And I think it's extremely valuable experience for these young players, you know, to go into this. Yeah.
How do you limit your possibilities with all those notes? I think sometimes, like, if you look at the fingering chart you wrote or like all the music you can find, it's like there's so much to do and so much to learn, which is beautiful, but there you need like something limiting to start off, and that's what I'm looking for in a way.
Then just pick 12 pitches and stick to it, and if you don't like these 12 pitches, then throw them away and pick 12 new ones until you find it, until you find something that works.
So that was your way for dealing with that too?
Yeah, and this is a way which provides infinite amount of scales for the rest of my life, because you are never coming to an end. There was never a scale I used twice so far, except for the consecutive overtone row, because it's so beautiful. But besides that, there's an infinite amount of pitch combinations, which I don't remember sometimes if I don't write down how this works like this, because if you just have the send values, then it's like solving a riddle that I also cannot solve sometimes. But it's more about the way how to get there and how to find pitches and how to organize and how to arrange them. And then there's a it's not like as I said previously in the video, it's not like that you have to practice everything. You can just choose what you like, and this is liberating, because it's not about, we are not robots, and I think this is completely dull if you would just practice without heart. Just play what you like, otherwise the music doesn't sound good.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So it's something, find something on the instrument that intrigues you, that you like, find a sound, and then explore it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the old jazz days, there was this concept of so-called false fingerings, where you could, you know, could produce the same pitch with a different fingering, and, well, almost the same pitch, mostly, but the timbre would change, and this was a very popular device back in the 30s, you know, with the honking tenor players, and so forth, and ever since. And so for me, for example, was, I think the when I think back, the first range that I discovered was on the soprano, where I would kind of change the register, not use the octave key, but go into the next octave with the side keys of the left hand, and which give a lot of flexibility of not from the only from the fingerings, but also from the embouchure, and you have like a whole new world, a space of pitches and timbres that can be modulated very easily. And this for me was a starting point, and from there later I was expanding my range on the instrument. And clarinet is a different story, it resonates differently, but I think by, you know, to be romantic, falling in love with the sound and exploring it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that all of us are the sort of players that aren't really into this whole thing of, you know, it should be like this, it's dogmatic. And when you go into this tuning and frequency world, you often encounter people or teachers or players that are saying, this is how it should be. We must play like this. We should play 432 hertz or what, you know. And I'm always a bit suspicious when I hear like how a tonal field should be like this or this. No, it's not. We choose that. We define that, you know, and we give the players we play with and our students like, you know, space to find that for themselves. I think it's something we all share. And, same with interpretation of classical music. Like, I'm sure Asya, you know, people say you must play Bach like this, or you must, you know. But I'm sure you're looking more for a much open, because music could be anything, really, you know. But I think hand in hand with this tuning work, I mean, the microtones goes a way of listening which I found intensifies the way you listen. You go into the sound of the sound of the other player, and thus you can, I find, blend more. And that's, in my experience, like the older I get, this is where the real music is happening. And that, you know, where I'm speaking out the obvious now, but these smaller tones seem to be a key into that real blend with other players, which I think I find really rewarding part of the music making.
By the way, does any of you guys have perfect pitch?
Fortunately, not.
I don't have it, and I always tell my student people, like, it doesn't matter. Actually, it's better. Don't even forget about it. I reckon you're better off without it.
Yeah.
You know, when you play a lot, you start. You're so close to your instrument, you can sing the sounds. But I don't think you need. I think it's a bit overrated. Yeah. Sometimes.
I don't actually know what perfect pitch is, because I just recently found out that there's so many different ways of perfect pitch. I mean, I can. I'm much better in telling which note an alto saxophone plays than a violin or whatever.
Yeah.
But I figured out that lots of microtonal friends, none of them has perfect pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like 3 weeks ago, I was teaching in Amsterdam a class, and one girl had perfect pitch. And I think she had a hard time.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, with saxophone in B and she had
a really hard. It's not easy sometimes if you have really like the best perfect pitch that you can tell any note in any situation that you are like really like this perfect pitch master.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I would also say, you know, it's along the lines of my previous thesis that this is like the unknown, uncharted territory that we are exploring. And from my experience, the few people with perfect pitch that I've known personally were quite conservative in their way of listening and performing music. So I don't know if this is like a psychological phenomenon. It's another topic probably completely, but I think it's interesting to address that, because some people would think, well, you know, it's hard, it's difficult enough to hear and differentiate between the 12 pitches, and now we are talking about 100 and how many?
It can be any pitch.
You know, over 100, so you really need to have, you know.
And for these people, this is torture. I mean, when does that A become the A flat, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At what point, you know? And why? Yeah. Why does that have to be an A? You know, it's part of this very rigid structure, I think, of thinking, which is good to break out of.
Yeah,
yeah. I think people with perfect pitch doesn't mean that you are musical. That you have musicality. How do you say that?
It's kind of memory, I think.
You know, not always. If you have perfect pitch, I mean, some it's just like.
Yeah.
So, do you use microtones in improvisation, because you talked about you found out that you like improvising
in the last
couple of years? Or
yes, sure. For sure, yes, I use it because it became absolutely my, let's say, the language is so natural to play it and to use it. It's really part of, really, really part of playing. So I use it, but I use it really only for emotion, let's say, if I want to show something, if I want to even to... It's a German word, even to blend. It was really mentioned already, to blend or to destroy or to show. It's like going there or these tensions, and we can make so much with it. And it's really, I think, very natural. That's why we speak also about new generations, or about all these young people, because it's becoming more and more natural for us. I don't know if it's connected with quantum physics or with understanding the world differently, or I don't know what we're transforming ourselves, our minds. But it's really a very natural part of it, so we are becoming more free with it. And it's only up to the feeling, let's say.
So, but it's just part of your language and part of what you feel about music, so it's not an intentional choice. That's how I understood it. Like, it's more like intuition. Like
for sure. As in improvisation, if I think if I would use it, it's only if I want to express something, and it's just the right way that I would feel, I think.
And if you use it in composed works, it's probably more like something that is very strict in a way. So
it depends of composer. I met different composers. There were really some of them with a big series about it, with a very exact notation, and it was really important for them. They could hear it, they could sing it, and it was really important to Yeah, to be as precise as possible, of course, possibly with emotions as well, not just machine, but as precise as possible. For some of them, as you mentioned, it's just quarter tone, some direction, it's enough already.
Yeah, it depends on how precise the composer is.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. How he's notating, and if you know him, if it's even better. So
then
you
need
know.
To talk. Right, you need to get into the work and talk about.
Yeah,
what he
either
wants
you know the people who worked with him, or you know him, or you know her, whatever. Yes. Depends of the language of each composer as each language of musician, I would say.
But so with some composers, you still have like the emotional connection and you choose to like have a certain pitch, even though there's a quarter tone written, you maybe have it a little higher, a little more sharp, a little bit flat.
Sure, anyways, also for the note in classical music, yeah. the major third should be lower as yeah. it's notated. So usually we use all these rules intuitionally to make it. It's I think perfect music wouldn't touch us at all.
So it's kind of similar for all fields. So
sure.
Nice.
Yeah, the other side, maybe Vincent, maybe interesting is the beautiful thing about this work, you could do it very intuitively or musically and just, you know, play it, hear it, and so on. It's also has a lot of number work, and I used to be terrible at mathematics at school and used to hate it. But with this whole overtone harmonic work, it really opened up the world of number for me, which can also be really a valuable experience for young people. And I like to think of these notes as like number that comes alive, you know. And right. Some of these overtones have very, very special characters, and I often work with, say, overtones like the 11th one, which is the first almost naturally occurring quarter tone, has a very, very particular sound, very, very different to the tritone as we know it. And and this world of 11 opens up in a number way. So this, I like the way in this work you can approach it from very different levels. You could also philosophically, universal laws, geometry, and so on.
Yeah.
But it's a very beautiful way of making that practically and beautifully understood, you know. It's also a very humbling work, because the more you go into it, I find it opens up so much, you realize, you know, how how much there is to do. So that's also a good aspect of this work of going into the tones, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, a number can be something abstract, or it can be something that really touches you. If I say 2 or 3, 4, 5, this is like an empty thing, but through music, these numbers become alive. And become,
yes, true.
And become and a meaning.
So simple, like the octave, which we take for granted, but this 2 to 1. I keep returning to these very simple parts of this whole thing that continue to amaze me.
I mean, isn't it strange that when you take a string on the monochord and you try to distinguish where is the center, you have two ways finding it out. Either you take your Steg and move it into the center, into the center, into the center, and you tune, and you will hit exactly the spot. We will have a perfect octave, like a millimeter, like really, 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 really precise. So your ear and your heart found the octave. Or the other approach would be, I have a string and I measure it out and I divide it in half the mathematical way. Both give me the same result, but the approach was different. And isn't it interesting that feeling, what we perceive, matches exactly the mathematics?
Yeah, beautiful. Well,
that's a scientific perspective. We've been talking about emotions and expression, and I think this is a seems to be important for all of us. And we certainly don't have the time to discuss this more in detail. What we mean by it. But I think that there is or might be a certain cliche or prejudice towards microtonal music that it is dissonant by nature. And I think, as you just said, you know, so it's not eliminating the traditional pure relationship of a perfect octave and other intervals, which quite the opposite come back into life if they are contrasted with another density or another listening experience. And I find this very liberating and a surplus, like a gift from a microtonal environment, that one can go back and play major triads or simple chords, and suddenly they come back into life, and if they're not surrounded in in this context, they would be, you know, cliche and vulgar and dull. So that's another aspect that I personally find interesting.
You can reinvent the basic things of about music. I mean, writing a triad. I remember when I was in jazz studies, you don't write triads because it's boring, that's old. And it's just not hip at the moment, but I mean, it's stupid in a way, but yeah, microtonality opens this up, yeah.
And I don't know about you, Philip, or the other guys, but I remember very clearly a moment when I was quite young, I don't know, maybe 6 or 5, and the first time I was at a piano, and I played just that C, E, G, you know, that triad, and I'll never forget just, yeah, but there's something, I just don't know what it was. Something like
become a
right.
Jazz man.
No.
But I had no idea, but that's a little, just one of those childhood memories that stayed with me. And find slowly, bit by bit, finding out about that is a fascinating journey that also tells you a lot about us humans and how we've developed. And I also find it fascinating how in this part of the world, like in Western Europe, how we've tended to, you know, we've tempered the octave, we somehow wanted to change keys and modulate, and this became the music that's mainly heard now. And other parts of the world are very different. And I'm fascinated by what brought that about, like what part of our soul or mentality needed to express itself in this way with more spaces or less spaces. And it tells us a lot about who we are, I think, in a very direct way.
So do you think microtonality found you, or you found microtonality? I'm serious.
I don't know. It seems the same thing for me, Philip. I mean, I couldn't separate that.
Halb zog sie ihn, halb sank er hin und ward nicht mehr gesehen.
So do you think that in a couple of years maybe there will be a new system of harmony, maybe? Because we talked a lot about melody and interpreting each note. Will there be a different way of approaching harmony?
No, I don't think so. Because harmony, it's already there, it's already written somewhere in the book. Someone just needs to open it up and learn from it. But I don't think that there's anything new to be invented. It's all already, if you read Vogel, if you read Kaiser, it's also, if you go back to Schönberg, who made in the harmonielehre spent one chapter about on microtonality, or Parch, I think it's already there. But I think that mainstream harmonic lessons in schools or somewhere else should more emphasize about why a major scale is a major scale, and how why do we have this 7-7-7-7 white and 5-5 black keys? Why is that? I think they should more emphasize that, so that you get a deeper understanding of the reason why things are how they are. You know, every harmony book basically starts with 1 or 2 pages of about the overtone series and blah 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 blah, and then therefore we start with the C major key, and C major key you have these and these triads, and then you start. And I think microtonality, what we deal, is just like an expansion of the first 2 or 3 pages of a harmony book in like 1,000 pages, because there's so much more to explore, which is still not taught in universities too much. I mean, I remember Parch felt betrayed when he found out after he studied that there's more than 12 notes per octave, and nobody told him, and he burned everything he wrote because he was so upset. And I understand that. Totally, because yeah, it's a limitation in a way, and I think this goes hand in hand, because the both theories about 12 tone harmony and microtonal harmony, they are basing on the same principles, on the fact that a number 3 ratio resolves into a number 2 ratio, that high numbers resolve into smaller numbers, that there's a certain hierarchy, that the dominant tonic relation is there for a reason, because it corresponds with the physiological, with the way our ear works and our hearing system works. And to support that into mainstream harmony, harmonic lessons would be just amazing, because people understand, students would understand.
Like with respect to our universities, there's obviously you know, a lot of Luft nach oben. Yeah, you can. Yeah. In many respects, we could improve this tonal learning. At the same time, I would say it's quite a short span of time we're talking about when we think of all that happened in the last 100 years in our music history.
Right.
And there are some encouraging signs, I find, in a relatively short space of time. Obviously, compared to human history or musical history, a lot has happened. So there are many good signs, you know, people everywhere doing great, great work with all kinds of harmonic ideas and whatnot. So I would just add in there are, you know, there's some reason to be optimistic when it comes to, you know, the future of our music and our instrument and that, you know, the saxophone.
Totally. I mean, if you listen to pop music today, there's full of microtones everywhere, like rock and roll and rap. It's all microtones. It doesn't fit into the 12-tone system. And this all would have been considered 50 years ago only as noise. Right? When the Beatles came, when the Beatles came on the scene, or I don't know, Presley, that was... people were disgusted by like the old traditional people, right? The older, and today, the mainstream, yeah, and the way we listen to mainstream music just has opened up to so much different kinds of colors. So it's strange that we are talking about these tiny microtonal adjustments that we want to do, that the third sounds a little bit more purer, whereas if you turn on the radio, there's so much distorted
noise.
Well,
I would also think that
Hendrix.
our globalized culture, not only on our musical culture, has been globalized, is continuing to be globalized and diversified and enriched by different influences. So it's not a question, I think, anymore of one prevailing or one way that will dominate. I'm personally not interested in that question at all, you know. So we could also talk about humanity. Will it survive the next 20 years, you know, and what will the music will be? I hope that it will survive, and I hope that we will find ways as humans to provide better lives for ourselves on this planet. And I will be curious to hear what music we'll be listening to in 10, 20 years, and hopefully we will, and what our aesthetic decisions will be at that time.
Mm. Yeah, a logical question from that would be, you know, following through on this podcast would be, in what ways can microtonality for saxophone improve the situation of the planet? What can it do to, you know, expand knowledge, you know, in what ways, how does this help, you know? I'm sure we all intuitively know the answers, but you know, the question is how much do we have to state? You know, we just do it. You know, we play it. You know, we go into the sound, and but I'm sure any kind of podcast like this, we're musicians, we interact with the world intensively. This is a big white elephant in the room about, you know, the world now as it is, and what role do we play? You know, but that's probably for the next podcast, Vincent.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, music in general. Yeah. I mean, the role of music, there's never been so much music around like today.
And so many different shades, too. I think that's a really beautiful thing, that there's not just, there was never just one tree, but in common sense, you have those pictures hanging in every music school with one tree and like roots. And then it's like Baroque and classical period and all that going on. And then it divides up and there's like also jazz, free jazz, and it kind of, I think it's nice that it's like so many things at the same time right now. So you have like classical music, you have like new music and all that stuff together.
But also, yeah, I absolutely agree. What I feel sometimes visiting jazz concerts with new music in jazz and new music in classical, it meets completely. Or sometimes the jazz new music is more new, sounds even more, let's say, for public sometimes hard to digest than some modern music in classical. So this is separation. I hope it will disappear. And yeah. I'm sure we meet each other there in this level. It's really mixing so much and it's becoming same, and the separation is really not.
Yeah, I think it's nice because it's also starting at the school. So like with your project, for instance, there's like classical players, players from a classical background, players from...
To speak.
Yeah.
Infamous speak.
Yeah. So I think that's something probably all of you guys would tune into, to say that that's the dream in a way, maybe.
Sure. I mean, there's tens of thousands of pianists that are able to play, let's say, the Waldstein Sonate by Beethoven perfectly. I mean, there's so many good musicians around, like never in the never before, probably, right?
Yeah, and I'm sure Asya knows more about this, but we have, you know, a phenomenon in a country like China.
Yeah.
Where we have now tens or hundreds of thousands of these, like, young saxophone players coming.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with them, you know? So let's...
Well,
Well, maybe they will all sound the same. Maybe it's not. I don't know. I think this these kind of questions are difficult to answer. And I think we are maybe in the best case we are building a new language and a language that is not that is free of certain borders that have been that existed traditionally, and that will allow us to communicate with each other over between genres, between cultures, and hopefully we will also have something to say and not just find a new language, because you know that's what we need the language for, to say something. And so that's of course the most important question. So what is it that we have to share? And music is tends to be tricky in that respect. You know, it has this affirmative quality, and we can just enjoy it. And but at the same time, we are aware of its political, social implications. And so I think that in that respect, and for me, this was very audible from all the things that we said in this short talk, that we agree on that, and this is a living language that we are learning and communicating and speaking and promoting.
But what about cultures? Actually, there are some cultures where it was existing already since such a long time, and all this division. Like there are cultures that are using microtonality so strong, and does it make breaches? It's just a question, actually. Does it make breaches now that we're talking about this microtonality, and it in our European world it's now so actual? Does it make breaches because of the other cultures where it was so natural all their life and history?
I really meant what I said my very first sentence, that I really truly believe that all music is microtonal. And you know, and where does music start? If we want, you know, it starts with the cry of the baby, and it's microtonal. That's how we communicate as humans. So we hear emotions in sound, and this sound is not pre-structured in a certain framework. And then, you know, and we invent these concepts, and we find them through science, and we find relations in mathematics and physics and so forth, and the cosmos, and you know, that's almost like a parallel discipline. But we create sounds, we produce sounds, and we communicate through sounds. And I think that it's really no question for me that microtonal music is everywhere. Yeah. It's a little deviation of the Western art music that seems to be not microtonal, but in truth it is.
I think I remember one quote of Lou Harrison, who said that microtonality, or the 12 equal temperate system, is also a result of the economization of the music industry. And I kept thinking about it, because if you would have in every country different tuning systems, or maybe region, how would you build a vast amount of clarinets, of saxophones, of pianos, of anything? Would make instruments much more expensive. I mean, I'm not talking about that they are pressuring us into 12 equal temperament, because it makes things handy. We can travel, we can play. But still, it's also good to define one common sense of tuning, which is not necessarily needs to be 12 equal temperament. And I think this is a field where microtonalists, as I would call us now, can spend some thoughts in it. Also, since we have electronic instruments and software now that can do anything we want, we're not restricted.
Maybe another factor also is like our talk. I mean, it's very hard in a short amount of time, but very quickly it becomes, you know, universal. We're talking about very, you know, big things relating to the world. And I think that comes a little bit from our instrument, because, you know, of course I stand corrected, but I know of almost no other instrument that can do so much, that's played in so many different ways all over the planet. Obviously you've got the voice, but there's something about the saxophone that just makes all this possible, you know.
And the theremin as well.
Which is an awesome thing about the instrument.
Yeah, I think it's no, there's a reason for it why it's such a iconic and popular, it has been iconic instrument in jazz music and in popular music. The same goes for the electric guitar, by the way, you know. So. Because it has a relatively easy accessible wide range of expressional possibilities. Mm. You know, try that with a piano.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you all very much. If you have any final statement to make for microtonality in music generally or in jazz, I'm glad to hear that, because you kind of answered all the questions I had, even though I didn't have to answer them, ask them. So if you have any last statement, I'm glad to hear that.
I'm sure we all prepared a written last statement.
My lawyer will provide it.
Okay.
Buy my record.
My is good.
No, but seriously, I'm very, very happy. Thanks for having us, and thanks to everyone in the round for sharing this experience. It was a great pleasure, and I mean it. And we should do this more often.
Yeah, I'm already thinking of applying for more money and to repeat that in a couple of years and see what has happened since then, and so we can see what's up then.
Half of us abandoned microtonality because we were miscalculating. The math didn't work out and was all a mistake.
On the pentatonic.
We can also have to take questions from your audience, Vincent. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So we have to work on those questions next time we meet.
But thanks so much for having us. It's been great to be a part of this.
Thank you for being part of this project. It was a huge thing for me. So I'm very thankful to have met you all. And looking forward to the next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
See you.
Yeah. See you.
No borders. World.